Welcome to the Squidcast,
a semi-regular update on all the amazing things international students at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut are up to. We have students from all over the world succeeding in so many academic and extracurricular pursuits that we decided to showcase a small sample, a tidbit, a crumble, a crumb, an inch, a millimeter for you metric fans of just some of their talent. And this interview is the first of those, recorded all the way back in October, and finally making its first breath above air into your ears today in February of 2020. It's with Cabello Matsoneng. It was recorded in our newly renovated international house on Vernon Street right here in Hartford, Connecticut. And in it, we talk about Cabello's life growing up in South Africa, and the novel that he's written, What We Inherit. We hope you enjoy.
Cabello, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Noah.
So we'll get a little bit into the book later, but I first just kind of wanted to talk a little bit to you in general, just kind of about your life, what maybe growing up in South Africa, if you could tell us some things about, you know, your background so that we can get to know you more.
Yeah, I lived in South Africa for about 21 years.
In what city?
I'm from Johannesburg.
Okay.
So Johannesburg is one of like the small cities, but it has, it's not small in terms of size, but in terms of population, it's one of the largest cities. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting, I think that's one of the reasons why I have been interested in the arts and the literary arts, because of Johannesburg, right? I think of Sophia Town and how Sophia Town was mainly a community of working class people, much more closer to the city, whose fashion still influences, like their style still influences contemporary designers. The music still influences a lot of contemporary performers. Their dance is still very much part of like the fabric of what people consider as like true South African dance, and mainly because it seemed to be a world that was not much concerned with what the apartheid regime was about, right? I think there was a lot of joy in at least what I've heard about Sophia Town and the art that came from Sophia Town. So I'm from Johannesburg. Uh-huh. All right, and then but it's much more of like a political city. Big court cases in the apartheid government were held there. Mm-hmm. But it's also a very beautiful city and a very rich city in terms of like resources, but also very paradoxical in a sense that you have the rich and you have the poor, mm-hmm. and they're just divided by one small street in many places. So yeah, I think like growing up observing that has always been very interesting to me, like why is that the case? And I grew up speaking about four languages.
We were having a conversation before hitting the almighty record button about, I asked what your first language was.
Yeah, so I grew up speaking Setswana, which is some variation of the Sotho group, Sesotho, Southern Sotho, and I can hear Northern Sesotho. I can speak a bit of Afrikaans, but I don't speak Afrikaans for political reasons. I am well-versed in English and I study the English language and English literature. And one would consider Setswana as my first language, which would not be entirely incorrect, but I think of language in a different way and how it operates, especially for people who come from multilingual backgrounds, mm-hmm. right? That your mother tongue is the language that you are born into. Mm-hmm. It's not a language that you choose per se, not the language that you operate in the world mostly, but English is a language that you operate in with in the world. So that's a language you use to study literature, the language that you use to speak about yourself in the world, right? But your mother tongue is a language of your imagination, I think, for me, right? I think of the poetry in Setswana, not in the form in itself, but the language in itself, and how like just like the construction of the language itself makes you sound very poetic. Even something isn't poetic, but there's a lot of poetry there. And I think of it as like a language of my imagination. I started writing in Setswana first, but I studied mostly in English, and English became my first language, mainly because it was the language that I operated in. If I'm doing work or I'm writing, that's a language that I know I am comfortable with, because that's a language I've been exposed to. So that becomes my first language by default.
You mentioned the poetic qualities of the languages that you grew up around.
Yeah.
Was poetry one of the first modes that kind of brought you to literature? Was that something that you were interested in as a kid?
Poetry has always been difficult for me. In all honesty, the form in itself, right? I've always been interested in sentences. I like poetry because it teaches me a lot about language.
Uh-huh.
And simply because of that, like, the form is very difficult, but for me, it's how I read poetry in Setswana from first grade until 12th grade.
So it sounds like sort of some of the literature that you first fell in love with was Setswana poetry.
Yeah. I mean, I fell in love with language through Setswana.
Do you come from a family that would tell stories with one another?
Yeah. My grandfather was a storyteller. I'll sit with my grandfather, and the funny thing is, like, when I was writing my first novella, when I was like 15, I was sitting with my grandfather and he was busy like saying things, and I was just like writing, right? And I loved the sound of his voice. And even because I've heard those stories so many times, for me, just like, I know what he's going to say next, so, but I'm busy writing the story and I was excited about that.
What's one of his best?
I forget some of them, but I think I remember he would tell stories about how if neighbors in a farm were clashing and both of them had supernatural power, we'll call it witchcraft. So if they were clashing, you would even see it in the sky that one would summon a lightning, and then one would summon a lightning that would strike someone.
Mm.
So for me, and if I would write a story about that, people say, oh, this is magical realism. And it's not magical realism. It's something that is real, that is happening, right? But for me, those things were very fascinating, and how he was able to vividly describe those places that he grew up in.
You've mentioned a grandfather, mm-hmm, whose relationship with the arts, mm-hmm, was something that inspired you.
Oh, my mom was a dancer, so.
I'm sorry?
My mom was a dancer.
Your mother was a dancer.
So, yeah.
And still, or?
No. So that's like back in the days, and
okay,
life happened.
I see.
Yeah, we've been artists. We're artists.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of something that's been part of your identity, mm-hmm, for a long time, coming, mm-hmm, to Trinity, even before Trinity. And here your majors are English
and human rights.
Human rights. And is there a creative writing component in English?
I'm a creative writing concentration major.
I love that word.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you're thinking about it really,
yeah,
hard. Yeah.
I concentrate in creative writing.
Okay. Well, something that occurs to me is you were talking about the books you were reading, mm-hmm, when you were young, and I'm sure that was far from an exhaustive list. But I wonder if when you came to Trinity, was there a discrepancy just coming from a different context, and in terms of what the literature that you knew and loved versus what you discovered other people knew, or did you find that there were more similarities than one might imagine?
I started reading very young, and I think by 10, that's when I started reading like full novels, mm-hmm, and enjoying them. And I read the African Writers series, and then I went to boarding school
in
South Africa.
Johannesburg?
Yeah, I went to the African Leadership Academy, and I studied A-level English, and read a lot of British literature, a lot. And that for me was very suffocating. That was when I was like, why am I reading a lot about people who just want to get married? Why am I reading a lot about white women who are losing property in the 1800s when people were still property, right? And like, for me, it was very frustrating. But I loved the language, mm-hmm, nonetheless, that they use in the stories. But for me, it was far away from my reality. The people I saw in the streets, when I'm like, wow, aren't these people like also deserving of literature? And that's when I started, in my second year, I was very rebellious to an extent. If I'm reading Jane Austen in class, I'm going to read Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. If I'm reading E.M. Foster, I am going to read K.S. Lodeka. I wanted to marry these texts that were Western and with those that were global, in a sense, right? Because not everybody in the world is rich. Not everybody in the world has property, right? But I wanted to write about the... I want to read these people who are somewhat closer to my world. Mm-hmm. And then coming to Trinity, and then you study literature and creative writing in an American institution, you realize how colonial the establishment is. And not Trinity per se, but like the establishment of like of literature, that there is great comfort in reading canonical texts, but canonical texts that are about white men, period. And even if we were reading about white women who wanted to get married, definitely like at least there was something other than white men who is describing breasts on a text, right?
Let's go ahead and turn, if we may, to this novel that you've written.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you would be able to share a few words sort of about the story in the novel. The novel is called What We Inherit.
Yeah.
If you might be able to give us a little bit of a summary or some key details.
Okay. So the novel starts with a nameless young boy who is meeting his client for the first time, right? And we never figure out why is he going to provide sexual services to a client, while we learn that he envies his friend's beauty. So we understand that he wants to be pretty, right? Mm. But his prettiness is not the most important thing, but it's presented as if it's the most like important thing in the beginning. And then he goes and services this client, and in that experience in itself, he begins to understand his desires, and he wants to be seen as beautiful even in those encounters. And it's a weird thing I was thinking about. I'm like, how are you providing a service and then you want to be complimented for how you look? Your job is just to be there. And for me, he was the kind of person who was telling me that I just don't want to be seen as an object. I want to be seen as a prize, even if I am, my services come at a price, right? So that's the one part. But in the second chapter, that's when we learn, like, oh, this is why he's doing it. He's providing, he's in sex work so that he may pay for his tuition. So the first part of the novel focuses on that. So that for me was very important to do, because in the past 6 years or so in South Africa, there has been a large movement, a big movement to have free education because in the transition to new South Africa, we are promised free education. And why is free education only relegated just to basic education from pre-K to 12th grade, right? So like, how about we expand the definition of this? Because there hasn't been any class mobility, like any significant class mobility. Instead, we have seen people drop out of university because they cannot pay for tuition. And my question was, okay, so what do people do in these situations, right? And it's not like there aren't funds or bursaries. They are, but they're not sufficient. So what do people do in the situations where they cannot pay for fees? And that's when I started thinking about this character.
Hi, it's February 2020, Noah. I'm in the process of editing this episode. So at this point, Cabello gave us an extremely detailed description of the entire plot of the novel and all of its twists and turns, of which there are many. And in order to preserve those surprises and to encourage you to purchase the book when it comes out later this year, I'm going to go ahead and skip ahead to the next part of our interview. I suppose if this were a real podcast, this would be the point when I would advertise something to make a buck. Instead, I'll just convey my gratitude for you listening this far and hope that you've enjoyed.
So yeah, I think that's a rough
No, it was quite thorough.
Of the novel. But yeah, that's what the story is about. It's mainly about family, right. and secrets and what secrets can do.
The section that you gave me to mm-hmm. read comes from what's currently chapters 8 and 9,
yeah.
and details a little bit of the reconnecting
yeah.
period that you mentioned mm-hmm. with the father's sister mm-hmm. and brother.
Mm-hmm.
And it also gives a little bit of insight into the severity by this point of the father's illness and yeah. sort of the inevitability of his downfall. I wonder if you would be so kind as to give us a little bit of a reading from okay. what's currently chapter 8.
All right. So I'll be reading from the middle section of those two chapters. So this is the point where they arrive. The first sentence will indicate that. My reading voice is terrible, so forgive me. I'm practicing. By the time we arrived at Al-Khadi's house, the sun had stopped flirting with the great scaled sky. It was not hesitant with its place in the heavens. It possessed the sky, as though we were small, with such small things in the constellation or the universe. The yellow-orange flavorful color of the sun almost had a smell, but we were small things that were not worthy of that scent. When Rahari snaked into the driveway with her black Land Rover, we were met by a sunflower that rose against the white wall. There was an orderliness about her house, her yard, as though she had copied the design from somewhere and made it her own. It was everything we didn't have, and I wondered what my father thought of his sister's house. I wondered if he envied her at all. I wondered about the scale of his dreams. How big were they? Did he give up when she left, when my mother left? When did he stop dreaming? And was the possible loss of ambition the actual sickness, the depths of the heart spoiled by the slow death of his dreams? I wondered and wondered and wondered for a minute until I heard my aunt call my father as if to wake him up. Though he was not sleeping, he was lost inside his head.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I think in that short excerpt, you're able to get... You were talking about how a lot of the book is about family. Mm-hmm. But also the disunity between the sister mm-hmm. and the father,
mm-hmm.
how even within the family, they have very different living situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it's something that I know on a personal level about, the class difference even within the family. And that's mostly caused by the change in the 80s and the 90s, right? So there was a growing trend in black professionals, right? So more people were going to college and getting college degrees and getting employed. So it was booming. It was the Mandela time, right? But still, things were moving fast at a superficial level, but they were not moving that fast. And some people were being left behind.
Mm.
But the father never finishes college, not because he didn't have enough funds per se, but because he and the mother's son were pregnant with this kid, and they had to make a decision that who gets to stay and who gets to leave, and then decided to leave school and make some living so that he can be able to take care of his wife. And they had made a promise that once you finish your medical degree, I'll go back to school, but they never did. And that's like also the cause of the tension between this couple.
It seems you have devoted a lot of energy to considering and in some ways empathizing with or and even inhabiting the decisions of your characters. It seems like you've devoted a lot of attention to trying to understand why people do what they do.
Yeah. I do that because my job as a writer sometimes is to judge, but sometimes is to imagine what could have been the reason.
But I think also, at least in my personal life experience, I find it's very difficult to know kind of why or even think about why my parents do or have done what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
We like to, I think, take for granted as
mm-hmm.
younger people, right, that what they've done has led to this and that's the mm-hmm. way it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you can uncover a lot by really pausing and thinking, But why is that the case?
Yeah, I think stories are important for that one reason, to understand why people do what they do, and then how do I respond to those actions, right? If I am affected by this, how do I respond? How do I respond to my, for example, one of the reasons why I wrote this entire novel was to try to look at my late father's passing and try to understand why did I react the way I did in certain circumstances, and how do people react to circumstances like this, right? So how do I write for my emotional truth, but not my lived truth, right? Not like the granular things, like the tangible things, but the heart of the things, right? How do I write about a child having a complicated relationship with their parent, a child looking after their parent?
And he passed away recently?
My father passed while I was still doing like draft of sorts for this novel. I thought I was going to publish short stories first, but I ended up writing a novel because the story just wouldn't leave me.
Right.
Yeah. But the section I just read was mostly just for me, because the last time I was with my father, he was on a hospital bed and I was saying goodbye. I will see you when you're out of this place, which was supposed to be the Christmas of 2018,
right,
when I was done with my first draft.
I'm resisting very heavily the urge to turn the conversation to myself as the interviewer, as somebody who also had his father pass away, and also last saw him in a hospital bed, expecting to next see him out of a place, right? And then I've also written about it. And the reason I asked you about this shift, and if you were able to find that, is I've always found, you know, people, since I've written my whole life, when this occurred to me, people would tell me, you should write about it. You might find that makes you feel better. And I always found the opposite.
Yeah.
Some of my greatest, if I can just, some of my my deepest moments of sadness and anxiety were rooted in the attempt to write about those experiences.
I think one of my favorite writers, she came to Trinity actually, and another favorite writer of mine is coming to Trinity today. Sisonkem Simang said something very profound a while back, and I was writing this, and okay, what she said was that it's better to write out of your scars than to write from the wounds, because scars give you a better perspective. Like scars are like, you look at it, for example, if I have a scar on my wrist, I can be able to look at this, and I'm like, the pain is not there anymore, but I remember what the pain was like. I can see it, but I see myself sutured, and that means I have healed, but that doesn't mean I have forgotten, and this thing still lives with me. But writing from a wound, you are less likely to look around you,
right?
And as a storyteller, it is important for me to write from scars than to write from wounds.
What you say about the writing from the wound being an act that is sort of for oneself, I can relate to that. I remember the things that I did write about my dad in high school, and went through and published in the school literary, you know, journal and shared with people. There was a sense in which even the act of sharing was like seeking out people reading it and going, you know what I mean? The sort of gratification that comes with sharing.
I think that's like what we do as writers. But I think what I was scared of was pimping my grief.
Right.
I was like, I don't want to. A part of me was resisting like writing, like knowing, like accepting that it is difficult for me to write about my father's passing in the manner in which like it would be clear to people like this is autobiographical, was that it would still be, then it would be a lot of people in it, and my father's passing is something that I want to understand for myself and still withhold to that, and something that's for me, and that's the part of like writing for yourself is mostly useful. But in writing a story, I'm like, okay, how do I write about this thing that I was scarred by, traumatized by? But how do I give it to somebody else? Mm-hmm. And when I give it to somebody else, how do I shape it for that person so that they can feel it?
I don't know what to say. I mean, I deeply admire the ability to look at things, to look at the personal, your personal experience in, mm-hmm. in that sort of artistic lens.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard doing that also, but I think when I started writing this, I didn't want to write it.
Right.
I didn't want to write it. I started writing it and I'm like, oh fuck. And then I wrote it and then I shared it on Twitter, and that's how I got my publisher. I shared it on Twitter and then my publisher was able to see it. And we started having a conversation right. from then on. And then I wrote it and I was still like, I don't want to write this. And I was like, the first draft was like, I don't want to write. The second draft was like, oh, I kind of think I can write this. And the third draft was like, oh, I should write this, right? But the ones there, I wanted to write a historical novel. And I was doing notes, I was doing research at that time. And when this happened, I was like, oh, then I have to pause this project. But I wanted to write a historical novel that uses primary sources. And I just wanted to write a rich historical. But this one was very important for me to do also, because it was for me just to clear the path, right? To say, hey, okay, let's move away from this now. We're not moving away, but let's package this.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, as little as you might have wanted to start writing this, I'm sure that I'm not alone in saying we can't wait for you to finish it and look forward and look forward to its imminent publication anywhere books are sold or online. Or
so in South Africa, it'll be available in bookstores,
right.
And you can buy it online. In the US, I don't know yet. That's a conversation I should be having with my publisher about distribution and everything. But right now, I'm not having that conversation with her. Mm-hmm. Like, I just want to talk about this. I don't want to think about...
Sure.
hopefully, it will be available still in 2020 in the US.
I see.
Probably on Amazon.
Right.
And hoping in bookstores in the US.
Well, we can't wait for that day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your time and your story.
You guys should buy like 100 cookies. I'm just
saying. Oh, yeah, yeah. You can make a little fort and absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Noah.
Of course. Thank you. Have a good rest of your day.
Can't believe I wrote those jokes.
Well, that's that. Thanks so much to Cabello for being patient as I worked to edit and publish this first edition of our Squidcast podcast, and thank you for listening if you've done so. We'll be trying to get these out on a semi-regular, at best case scenario, monthly basis, and there's lots of other people to talk with, and I'm really looking forward to it, and I hope you're looking forward to listening with us too. Be sure to follow the Office of International Students and Scholars on Instagram. We're at TrinOISS. Always got fun stuff going on around campus, and if you think you know someone who should be interviewed next, or if you would like to be interviewed, go ahead and email Noah, email me, or DM us on that Instagram that I just mentioned, and we'll reach out. Thanks so much. Have a great rest of your life.